AI has other implications when it comes to really reading minds and complex sort of peace processes. I mean, they're talking about using AI to generate constitutions. You know, it sounds like maybe viable machine, you know, or technological wise, but imagine a social contract defined by a machine.
Welcome to On Air, a podcast discussion at the intersection of artificial intelligence and international relations, where we will discuss the development of IR theory, law, and practice in the age of AI.
From Tokyo, Japan, I'm your host, Chris Lamont, joined today by my co-hosts, Medlier Mema and Young Diogenes. In today's episode, we have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Gesine Visoka, an associate professor of peace and conflict studies at Dublin City University in Ireland, who will talk to us about the shift from analog to digital approaches in international relations and peace building. But before we do so, Medlier has a question he's been dying to ask our Young Diogenes.
That's right, Chris. There is actually a question that, and this goes back to some of the discussions that we have had with black ball scenarios, right? Where we talk about, you know, the possible turning points in history, that we are in front of some very important decisive moments. And some of it might not even be choices, right? It may be just that, you know, the choice in a way is made for us.
It's like critical junctures in terms of historical institutional
critical junctures, but also we're walking into it blindly. I think at least Young Diogenes, you've talked about black ball scenarios as such, right? We're kind of like we're blindly pulling a ball out of it. Well, in line with that, I was reading over the weekend something by William McCaskill, who I think some of the listeners and you may know associated with effective altruism. But he had written a couple of years back this very long review article, which I'm sure, YD, you're familiar with, on Derek Parfit's Hinge of History thesis. But for the benefit of our listeners, I just want to read a very quick paragraph here. And then I'd just like to get your reaction, of course, Chris's as well, on what you think of it, right? But let me get to this paragraph that summarizes the thesis really quick. So this is what Parfit says about his thesis. It says, "We live during the hinge of history. Given the scientific and technological discoveries of the last two centuries, the world has never changed as fast. We shall soon have even greater power to transform not only our surroundings, but ourselves and our successors. If we act wisely in the next few centuries, humanity will survive its most dangerous and decisive period. Our descendants could, if necessary, go elsewhere, spreading through this galaxy." So there is this ominous sounding kind of warning, right? It's like there's a hinge, but there's also an optimistic ending, right? But also there's a sense that we are in control of our decisions right now. And again, the black ball kind of scenario implies that we're not necessarily in control of that, as I was pointing out, that we may be walking blindly towards our doom. But here, Parfit and by extension McCaskill tend to strike a more optimistic tone. Where are you on this, Young Diogenes? What do you think of Parfit? Who's Parfit, first of all, and this hinge of history argument?
So Parfit is a pretty famous moral philosopher. I think he died maybe 2017. It feels like it's been within the last decade, won a bunch of awards. And in the context of this discussion and McCaskill's kind of summary and argument against, I tend to go with Parfit's interpretation more than McCaskill's. And we can talk about why that is. And
now, that's interesting. So what's the distinction?
What McCaskill does in this particular hinge of history discussion, from my perspective, by the way, I'm going to do my best to steel man his perspective rather than straw man it. But he takes a couple quotes from Parfit that Parfit didn't necessarily explore that deeply. I think there were three main quotes, and kind of tries to suss out what Parfit likely meant. So summarize Parfit's argument, which he admits may not be a totally accurate summary, and then have some supporting arguments and some arguments against it. But he basically goes down the side of being against Parfit's argument, which is that we are living through a hinge of history. And he's fairly probabilistic about it. So the way it reads is...
Who is he? Is this Parfit or McCaskill now?
McCaskill. McCaskill's okay. Fairly probabilistic about it because Parfit didn't really make that much of an argument. You know, McCaskill will admit in one footnote, all right, well, he had maybe one supporting argument, but I'm going to say that he just made these claims, but here's how I think he would support these claims. And then I'm going to basically argue against my summary of his claims.
Right. What are the claims that Parfit makes? And it's kind of strange to talk about somebody who has only passed, you know, 5 years ago. And it's so, there's so much controversy about what he really meant. I mean, you would think that there would be a pretty good record of what he meant and intended. And then 2 years after he dies, right, you have McCaskill's like, well, I think if I'm going to like go through this archaeological dig and unearth the real intent of, I mean, that was only 2 years earlier that the, or yeah, 8 years earlier that he had written this book on it.
Yeah. He died a few years ago, but I think he wrote it in like 2011.
2011, yeah. So what is the original argument? And then, so that I think for our listeners, so we don't confuse them, perhaps.
Well, the original pseudo-argument. I think the quote you listed is basically the core of the argument, which is, and this is one that's pretty popular in Silicon Valley, I think, right now, which is basically, this is a really important time in history, perhaps the most important time in history, and the decisions that we make now as human beings are going to potentially affect trillions of future progeny that may be living on other planets if we get it right or wrong, or we may snuff out of existence entirely if we don't manage the current time period correctly. And he describes it, McCaskill describes it in terms of how influential individuals are.
That's really interesting. And I think that one thing that we tend not to hear as much of is the latter part of that argument, right? The risk that surrounds this period in time. And you've had others write about, for example, Crawford writing about the environmental costs of digital technologies and AI, that they all need a physical infrastructure that requires intensive mining of rare earth minerals. That's incredibly disruptive. We are living at a time where there's a severe energy crisis, that there's a fossil fuel crisis, rapid climate change. Is perhaps the kind of the Silicon Valley take perhaps too much or a little too optimistic?
Optimistic in what sense?
Well, optimistic in the sense that we are setting the trajectory for the kind of next 1,000 years of human life. It's kind of assuming, right, that a slow creeping cataclysmic event is not on necessarily on the horizon.
Well, I think Parfit would say it's we got to worry a lot, just to oversimplify. And McCaskill would say we don't really have to worry, at least from my perspective, the way I read it. The way he structures the argument, in my opinion, isn't as thorough as Bostrom would, or he also mentions Eliezer Yudkowsky. Those guys, I don't know how to put this, but they're really good in their philosophical papers at describing, here are all the possible outcomes. And from my perspective, what McCaskill does is he says, well, here are the likely arguments. So he kind of, in my opinion, strawmans the arguments a little, and then uses a lot of probability theory to say why we don't have anything to worry about. So an example of this would be, if you look across time and you take any given moment, I'm paraphrasing, but he would say, all right, if you take any given moment, what are the chances that this moment right now that we're talking to each other and the things we're talking about right now are the most important things that are ever going to happen in history? Mm-hmm. And I think the three of us would admit, probably not the most important event ever in history. And so he constructs it a little more broadly to say, well, what's the probability that during this, you know, next 10 years or 100 years that we're living through that event? And would say, based on the probability that goes through in the argument, well, chances are, since we've been fine in the past, we'll probably be fine in the future. And the current time period right now does not fit that criteria either. And what I would say to that is, I think after, let's say, John Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev went through the Cuban Missile Crisis, there are probably moments in there where they were like, this is a real hinge in history. So, and this isn't like any other moment. And so when I'm reading it, I kept thinking, you know, I have eyes. I can see when something is more significant than something else. So strictly thinking of this entire time period as probabilistic and saying, well, we'll be fine. Human beings have a tendency to figure it out seems kind of not a great way to make the argument.
And just to be clear, my initial question was aimed more at McCaskill's argument in relation to this, because on a very superficial level, it did kind of remind me almost of this techno-solutionism that previous guests have raised as a concern, as a risk in emerging tech, that we see technology as kind of containing within its solutions for all of our societal problems. And then you throw into the mix that probabilistically we're probably fine, seems to be a recipe for discounting many of the very serious risks that we're facing today.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say that as we become more technologically capable, and I'm not the only one saying this, and we have the ability to do more, for example, the classic example is nuclear weapons, that things do become more dangerous, and that this time period isn't like any other time period, and that our decisions do matter more because our ability to affect an entire planet is greater. And I didn't really see a lot of that in the 25 pages that he wrote.
Right. This discussion does remind me of our previous conversations, because I know that YD, you tend to be a bit more realistic or pessimistic, and it's strange because generally, I am also a little bit pessimistic just about the impact of technology, but I'm a little bit more optimistic about the future, which is kind of strange, right? It's a weird, I'm not sure how it works. It doesn't add up. But the reason for that is because, and a lot of this goes back to what you were talking about, that there's not necessarily just one hinge point in history. There's many. And what that implies, at least in my mind, is that, and then going back to the black ball kind of like analogy, is that every hinge point in a way has a reconstituted bowl of balls, right? So it's not that you're removing these possibilities and then eventually you'll be left with just the black ball, but the possibilities and the probabilities remain the same, perhaps even smaller for a cataclysmic kind of event, because the bowl itself, where the balls are in, actually gets refilled. And I think with technology, you perhaps get even more. Perhaps you get more black balls as well, but statistically speaking, you probably have a better chance of pulling out a white one rather than a black one. Does it make sense what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Let me also kind of recategorizing something that you've indicated relative to our levels of optimism and pessimism, because I actually try really hard to be optimistic, and I think I'm quite optimistic. Let's divide it this way. Like, I'm optimistic after a negative event has happened that human beings will figure out a way to solve it. So I'm very optimistic in our abilities to do that. But where my apparent pessimism comes in is that those trigger points of where we're not paying attention, or we're paying attention, but we're not doing anything about it, and then the event happens, that particular event, those kinds of events are getting more and more dangerous. So my pessimism comes from the type of event, not in our ability to actually do something about it.
So then this gets me to another one, because I introduced... in our conversation in the past, at least off record, I've mentioned the Russian-American historian Peter Turchin, who is a very interesting person, and I've been following him for some time, and he's got this view, what's called the cloud dynamics or Cleo dynamics view of history. Some people have accused him of being, of kind of like bringing forward like more cyclical view of history. But does history repeat itself?
Well, to the degree that we haven't changed our genetics and,
The hinge of history argument obviously kind of seems to just have this more almost like, once you get this turning point, it doesn't repeat, right? You're going forward. But you're talking about here about several hinges of history. But are these getting us back to the starting point, these hinges of history? I mean, are we starting over, or is this a linear upward progression towards a more and more advanced technological kind of society?
Well, I'm talking about the hinges getting more dangerous. So in the sense that they're...
But where do we end up once we get to the hinges? Like, so we get past the hinge. Do we get back to the starting lineup, starting point, or are we actually thrust forward and then move, you know, so there's no repeat of the past?
I mean, that's a difficult question to answer because it depends on whether you're talking about a really local, like a narrow phenomenon in a particular city or family, or if you're talking about an event that has national or international proportions. I think a lot of the smaller events, we do end up making the same mistakes over again. I think historians would agree too, because we haven't learned from history. The bigger ones that we're all kind of aware of when it comes to, again, how we deal with nuclear weapons or in the future, maybe AI, those ones, the information gets around. And so they still possible for them to repeat, but it's less likely because more people have information about it and we're all kind of trained on it.
Yeah. Well, for our listeners, I think, and then because I know we're coming to the end of this, but yeah, there, I mean, because I tend to think of myself personally more in terms of cyclical, right? Where there is, because even if you think about the hinge itself, it can close on itself, right? So it's like the starting point, the end point could end up being the same, not necessarily just opening out, but opening, you know, closing inwards, and then you're closing in on yourself. But again, Turchin's view, this clear dynamics view of history, to me, it's kind of fascinating. It's interesting because it does seem to bring in some aspects of the cyclical view of history, but that allows for exogenous shocks that can, you know, kind of thrust forward because societies evolve, obviously, and humanity evolves. And so you have a different set of challenges. But there are certain patterns in human history that do repeat, right? And perhaps one of those patterns is the hinges, right? There are hinge points in history, right, that continue to go forward. So that maybe there is a way of reconciling this hinge of history argument with a more, not cyclical, because I think Turchin, actually, I remember, I think it was on Twitter just a few weeks ago, he got really upset because somebody characterized what he does as a cyclical view of history. It's like, that's not what we do. But that there are some repetitive patterns within this broader evolution, so to speak, of historical patterns.
I would say that to the degree that we don't change as human beings and don't learn from our history, that we'll repeat ourselves, nothing too earth-shattering there. But to the degree that the technology and the institutions and the understanding of sociology gets better, then the hinges are different. So it kind of depends on what you...
That has a very, there's a huge assumption there that it's individuals driving history and humans driving history rather than structural systemic forces. But if we're not the ones driving history, if it's other forces that are driving history, then perhaps it's not as important that we learn or not, because then you move forward regardless.
I agree that for the most, I think human beings are often more driven by systems than individuals. If you put people in the wrong kind of system, you'll get certain kinds of results. But then we're back to, is a corporation its own thing or is it a bunch of individuals? So yeah, I think we probably agree, but go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, no, I mean, the reason why I've been quiet is just kind of been thinking about this. And it's kind of this, is it cyclical or is it linear? Seems to be kind of the wrong dichotomy through which to try to understand these types of questions. On the one hand, the idea of linearity and progress is one that's deeply embedded in like modernization theory and its predecessors, like in colonial and imperial projects about kind of civilization and technology and how that destroyed much of the world, much of kind of many places of in this world and environments and the huge cost that inflicted, kind of then being kind of reconstituted in this technological form again, where technology is seen as containing within itself some kind of progress or emancipatory potential, despite the fact that, as we have discussed in many episodes earlier, that these technologies are kind of more likely to reinforce and replicate existing problems, social problems, rather than contain their solutions. So a very interesting debate, but I was just kind of thinking kind of along a slightly different angle here. But unfortunately, we are out of time for this introductory segment. Thank you so much, Young Diogenes.
Thank you as well.
And also Medlier for bringing this very interesting topic to our attention. And now we'll turn to our guest.
Dr. Gzim Visoka is Associate Professor of Peace and Conflict Studies at Dublin City University. His research focuses on post-conflict peace building and state building, transitional justice, global governance, foreign policy, and diplomatic recognition. Currently, Dr. Visoka serves as Deputy Editor of Peacebuilding Journal, founding editor of Rutledge Studies in Statehood, co-editor of Rethinking Peace and Conflict Studies, and founding co-editor of Palgrave Encyclopedia of Peace and Conflict Studies. Gzim, Mirsevina Pogramintón, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome, Gzim. It's great to have you.
I chuckled there a little bit because, and that's only like what, like a tenth of your CV. I mean, we would spend like the next hour just kind of like just listing all your accomplishment. But, and you are also a father. Today you're coming straight from, you know, dropping off your kids at school. And we're talking about the tales of and the adventures of academics. How do you do all that? You know, how is that possible? Do you sleep? Do you eat? Do you go to visit your family once in a while?
Yeah, it's really kind of, yeah, it's full on at the moment. Certainly, yeah, busy with work and kids and family and, yeah, social life has to kind of, you know, be parked aside for a while. But yeah, you'll be surprised how, you know, how resilient we are and how we try to manage everything. It's about this sort of, you know, queuing system. I learned from a colleague, sort of, you know, you work on multiple things and then you have to queue, put in the queues, a couple of things and then move on with other projects. And then eventually they get done.
Okay. Well, you anticipated my question. I mean, because in, you know, half seriousness or full seriousness here, it's just that, you know, there's a lot of our listeners that are graduate students or young academics and they would want to accomplish the things that you have accomplished. And I guess what's the best advice you can give? And I guess one advice is queuing, right? So did you want to maybe just another 30 seconds on that?
Yeah. So it's about having an ambition, a research program, really an interest on this field. Academia is not 9-to-5 type of work. You need to have passion. You need to have some normative, ideational goals that drive you to do the work we do. It's really kind of really self-inflicting work. You know, I must say, research, it requires a lot of discipline, constraining in terms of social life and our personal life. So you need to have that drive to make you move. And then once you have that, and then I think it's about finding a way to manage your time the way you feel most comfortable. For me, it works by kind of, you know, working on multiple projects and advancing some of them and then putting in the queue and then starting new ones. Yeah. So you have to plan in advance. At the moment, I'm planning book projects for 2025. but they're just really kind of empty shell ideas. And over time, as I finish existing projects, they will, take shape and then, you know, be done. So that's how it works. It's about sort of really keep going and move on. Otherwise, if you work on a thing at a time and, then there might be some sort of, you know, hiccups and surprises and hence gaps.
I gotcha. Well, for our listeners, my introductory comment was in Albanian. Your name is Albanian. We have never met each other, of course. Our listeners know that I am from Albania as well. But if my wife were here, she would say, well, you know, this tendency to also do a lot of things and to be busy all the time. She wonders whether it's an Albanian thing as well. There's a certain sense of like, you know, running out of time and just wanted to just get as much done as you can. Any sense on that?
I think it has to do with the historical foundations of our nations. We've been suppressed for so long. We didn't have opportunities as individuals and society. And I mean, I remember growing up in Kosovo, partially before the war and then after the war, we had very little opportunities to learn, grow, and innovate. And so I guess the energy I have at the moment is accumulated from the lack of opportunities that I've had when I grew up. I had no library. I had not enough books, no, you know, chances to really test my talents. So, yeah, I guess, you know, the older I get, the more I'll compensate for. So I think it has to do with that sort of historical individual collective compensation for lost time.
Okay, that's wonderful. It makes sense to me at least. So thank you so much for that. Chris, take us on to the main topic for today, which is...
Well, this has already been really, really fascinating. And I was just going to comment that Medlier, and you also work for a Japanese university, and you're in a country that's also associated with putting in long work hours. Going on though, one of the things, and speaking of being passionate about research interests, one of the things that I guess all three of us have a very strong interest in is the prospective impact of emergent digital technologies on the fields that we've spent a long time working on, right? Whether that be transitional justice or international justice or peace building or development. And I guess the first question is just, is a kind of a big one. And that's, do you see artificial intelligence or AI as just another tool or instrument? Or is it kind of a defining development that marks like the next stage in human development? Like, is it something that, is it just another technological tool that is leading us down kind of this same trajectory, or is it something that is potentially transformative?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So I suppose there are two ways how we can approach this question. One is sort of, you know, try to learn from past and see how other sort of, you know, major eruptions and changes in human development have taken place. Or kind of really have, you know, take a leap and think forward. I think I am kind of more inclined to believe that there is a mutual constitution between the social and technological. So neither of the fields at the moment dominates the other. So remember in early 90s and even earlier, there was kind of this sort of perception of technological determinism, believing that there's a, you know, there's a black box out there and technology gonna happen. We can't shape it. So society, state was quite, you know, developing separately from technology innovation and sort of, you know, private sector. But over time, we've seen that there's a lot of convergence. The technological cannot do without the social or the human at the moment. So technosphere, certainly it is taking its own path. At the moment, it is shaped by politics, legislation, constraints of the social. So there is an episode of openness and closure. Just take, for example, sort of the American or the Western logic of internet freedom versus Chinese, Russian internet sovereignty concepts. So there are kind of, you know, typical examples, the paradigms that kind of gives us an idea of how the social and technological are co-constituted. So at the moment, I think they're kind of in a equal level field, sort of one shaping the other and vice versa. But I would not rule out the possibility that we are going in the direction that the technology, artificial intelligence will dominate the way how we think, be, and act in the world. But it's a process. It's kind of, you know, slow process, one taking over the other gradually.
That's fascinating because in some of your own work, I detected a little bit of, I guess, caution when it comes to the impact of these technologies, because there's a lot of, in the words of some of our kind of previous guests, techno-solutionism out there, right? Where we see kind of technology as unlocking all sorts of predictive potentials and all sorts of other potential avenues for action, which previously didn't exist, particularly in the humanitarian sector.
No, certainly, I am in that side of caution, primarily because prior to engaging in this debate or discussion on digital peace and digital technologies in IR, sort of my research has been on critical IR, critical and peace and conflict studies, and our way of thinking is really kind of, you know, rethinking, questioning, especially the problem solving ways of doing things. Sort of, you know, we have seen that efforts for progress and innovation in when it comes to peace and conflict can have adverse effects. So it's really important to be cautious, to consider all factors, all circumstances before, you know, kind of, yeah, leaping towards this sort of, you know, technological solutionism, as you mentioned. And especially, you know, matters concerning war and peace, human life. Assuming that the digital or the technology would resolve a lot of problems, it's misleading. And it's having actually a negative impact. And that's kind of, I think at this stage it's important to ethically, politically unpack and question this sort of, trajectory.
Well, this is actually a very good, I think, conversation. I want you to hold on to that for just 1 minute because I want to address a related question and then come back to exactly this kind of conversation because I'd like to just talk about the implications of AI for peace building, peacemaking. But before that, a bigger question first, and then maybe we can go, because this gets back to, and I think you answered part of that when you're talking about, is this an age-defining kind of development, or is this just this mutually constitutive kind of like relationship? And I think you're talking about the latter rather than the first. And so I suspect that I know the answer to this already, but the same question can be asked now with regards to the impact of AI. I mean, you write mostly about digital technologies, right? But I mean, we can talk about emergent tech. We can use the term AI as part of these emergent tech. And I've been thinking, I mean, this whole podcast, right? It's IR in the age of AI, international law in the age of AI, international security in the age of AI. And so we assume already that things perhaps are different in this new age, at least the way we see it, in this new fourth industrial kind of revolution. When it comes to the study of IR, does it make sense to speak of an age of AI? And I won't feel offended when we're talking about this podcast, but in the sense that, do you think that when it comes to the existing paradigms of international relations theory, right, that we need to start, I know that you teach a course on this, by the way, parenthetically, right? You teach a course where you talk about, digital tech and human rights and this and that. Do you think that we need to begin exploring new avenues for, theoretical paradigms?
Yeah, no, so I think you guys are ahead of everyone else in the sense of kind of considering AI age. I think at the moment, IR is in the digital age. 20, 30 years ago, it was in ICT's sort of age. So when I say digital IR or digital age, I mean we are in that stage where digital technologies of kind of more conventional nature rather than artificial intelligence or more advanced automated and sort of, machine learning takes place. Obviously, there are some subfields that is being tested, but predominantly we see a domination of a struggle between the analog and the digital still. That's sort of a constitution between the traditional and kind of more innovative ways of thinking and doing IR. I think, if we take the digital as the present age of IR, we have a lot of evidence to support that. For example, ontologically, we're starting to think a bit differently and moving beyond the analog, sort of taking into account digital realities or digitally kind of envisioning the world. So the promise of digital technologies in the study of IR is also expanding the ways of how we know what's out there. The epistemology of IR, the ways of knowing using machine learning, using technological, methods for data collection, big data kind of extraction and prediction. All of that is really kind of changing the way how we think about what's out there and what counts as data. It's expanding significantly. And most importantly, it's changing the way how we study IR, methodology of IR, sort of, how we collect, observe war, peace, democracy, and digital technologies itself. So there's overwhelming evidence supporting the sort of, the claim that I think we are at the age of digital IR age, but we're moving that direction of artificial intelligence. I mean, if you see the UN, other organizations are trying to innovate and kind of work with private sector to really sort of, move in that direction to let the machines do the job for us.
So Xim, if we then assume for a moment that you're correct, and I have no doubt that you are, if we take that as a fact, then what are the implications for IR theory?
At the moment, what's happening is that we're studying the digital using the analog ways of knowing and thinking mostly. So this is a really interesting way of thinking, and it's also happening in practice. Sort of policymakers, practitioners, with exception of some kind of really futuristic minded innovators. Most of people who study and practice technologies really are still embedded in the analog ways of thinking and acting, and that's kind of present. For example, when we think about the study of war, digital diplomacy, democracy, humanitarianism. So basically, we're talking about the digitalization of existing analog forms of being and doing, and not necessarily something new. So when it comes to IR and its implications, we're still really operating the same paradigms. So if you take it positivist and post-positivist ways of thinking, which kind of they were kind of a traditional divide in IR, sort of most of the thinking in technology, it's embedded in the positivist thinking, believing that there are sort of, you know, ways of progressing, of changing and finding solutions to problems, and sort of, you know, using technology as means to that innovation, as opposed to then critical scholars who bring up the ethical, political, critical implications of these changes. What does it mean for democracy, representation, legitimacy, and so on and so forth, especially when it comes to the algorithmic ethics, how they replace the human agency, human desires, and so on and so forth. So certainly, if you think about the AI age in a paradigmatic sense, it makes sense because, you know, Kuhn's paradigms way of thinking operating on the logic of ruptures, of leaps forward. I don't believe that's the case how we know and act in the world. I think I'm more kind of, you know, in the Lakatosian way of thinking. Imre Lakatos argued that we should not, paradigms are, it's not the way how we should approach knowledge. It is around research programs. And research programs constitute positive and negative heuristics. Positive heuristics is things that we want to study to advance our research program. And negative heuristics is things to avoid that kind of very much falsify our claims. And everyone operates through that sort of, you know, and try to kind of contribute to the positive heuristics of their research program, which is called by expanding the protective belt. So I think what we have at the moment is coexistence of multiple research programs. Some of them are very analog, others are very much digital, some are mixed and caught in between. So there's a spectrum of ways of thinking and acting, which is very much merging and allowing both analog and digital paradigms to coexist, or research programs, without really one replacing the other.
This is really interesting. And I think one of the things that I've kind of noticed is that there's a tendency to attach kind of the digital as like a prefix, right? So digital transitional justice, digital humanitarianism, right? Digital. And as you mentioned, a lot of that focus is kind of embedded in positivist assumptions about seeing these digital tools as another variable that can be thrown into the mix to achieve particular outcomes. And one of the things I really found interesting about your answer is you seem to be suggesting that we're kind of approaching it the wrong way, that we're not asking the big question, the ontological question of what is the digital, right? And what does that mean, right?
Exactly. And it's also very, very challenging to kind of, you know, really kind of leave behind, you know, what has been ontologically secure for us.
Right.
I remember, I mean, this, if we completely endorse or cherish the digital or AI, it means that, you know, we strip ourselves of all agency in terms of ethical, moral, you know, political agency, and give up all of that for something that is uncertain and out of our control. So certainly I understand why, you know, then there's that sort of, you know, attachment to the analog while still kind of accepting the digital as a tool or a means to continue reproducing the analog. And by the way, analog is not bad. Analog is about relations. It's about security. It's about continuity. It's about relatability. And that's the foundation of society, the social. So there is something, you know, to think about and talk about when, because progress, innovation is not necessarily good all the time. I'm not conservative in this sense, but I'm kind of more cautious to kind of, you know, endorse something that might really throw out sort of tremendous progress we've made in terms of rights and ways of being and sort of knowledge. And so we have an optimal level of being. And then if we kind of constantly throw that out, you know, where do we end up?
That's a difficult question to answer. I find it fascinating. Going back some years, there was a lot of optimism about digital spaces as kind of leveling the playing field, giving serving as this kind of empowering almost plane where kind of people can get word out, or you can document atrocities, for example, is one example in relation to that we see kind of ongoing. But on the other hand, in terms of relations, it also amplifies a lot of the negative relations that exist, right? So there's a lot of inequality in the digital realm as well, in terms of access to data, access to information, and as such. So as you mentioned earlier, the contrast between the digital space in a country like China, which has devoted a lot of state resources to monitoring and control of that digital space, versus a digital space in a country like the United States, which is kind of almost the opposite in many respects. But it does seem that states are beginning to internalize almost these governmentalities of governing the digital space as well, as more and more states increase regulation of that. So lots of fascinating things to consider there. And in terms of relations, though, how do you see that playing out in the, like you mentioned, the analog is not bad in terms of relationality, but what about relationality in this new plane?
Yeah, so I suppose I could respond to that in relation to the field of study that I'm most interested in, also what I've recently observed more, it's kind of to do with digital versus analog piece. And you covered some of those issues. So certainly, the digital has been one of the fields where civil society networks have tried to escape from the limits of the state-centric system of sovereignty, territoriality, constraints of movement, of ideas, and so on and so forth. So it had that early, really sort of, you know, emancipatory function to really liberate our ways of thinking and being and overcome the legal constraints and many other sort of, you know, institutional settings that sort of, you know, over time became blockages to freedom. But then soon we realized that actually, you know, the digital can also be co-opted by authorities and turn that against freedom, against human liberation and emancipation. And there is growing evidence showing that sort of, you know, states are still kind of, you know, reproducing their selves in the digital age and using it for their interest. From you know, populism in the internet to misinformation, fake news, to other sort of, you know, ways of surveillance, curtailing social movements, disrupting social movements and change, and so on and so forth. So it's as any other technological innovation or progress in the past, we're still stuck with the state system or state authorities. And this is kind of, you know, the key to discussing when we kind of talk about also for the digital peace or digital peacemaking, because it is showing, the early evidence is showing that actually it's not as promising as we thought. Sort of for peacemaking processes, the state system really kind of, you know, it's not working. I mean, there are over 50 conflicts that are not resolved. Some of them are about secession, others are about regime change. So the digital was one of the ways that we try to escape or try to kind of, you know, avoid this Westphalian sovereignty or sort of state-centered way of being. But we're seeing that it's actually just reproducing the old ways of being and acting. And that's kind of, you know, dangerous because from digital peacemaking to humanitarianism to development, we're seeing that still state is there. And actually, it's just condensing or curtailing human rights and liberties rather than sort of, you know, expanding them.
Well, Zitma, I was going to actually ask you this question a bit later, but since you anticipated that, and then we'll come back to the issue of digital peace. Back in 2017, there's a book by Taylor Owen, Disruptive Power. It talks about the crisis of the state in the digital age. And his take is very different in many ways. And maybe it was optimistic back then. I mean, we've seen a lot over the last 5 years, principally among that, something we've talked about here quite a bit, which is digital authoritarianism, right? States kind of co-opting, again, digital technology for empowering, strengthening, and reifying kind of traditional state powers. But at least 5 years ago, and I'm going to try and get Owen on this show because I want to ask him myself how he feels now, 5 years later. But he says that in every aspect of international affairs, digitally enabled actors are changing the way the world works and disrupting the institutions that once held a monopoly on power. And primarily among these institutions, he identifies a state, but then he also talks about international corporations and international organizations as well. And he identifies a series of non-state actors that in his view are empowered as a result of this digital revolution, let's say. I mean, it seems that you disagree with that assessment.
Not necessarily on those premises, because, okay, again, it is the old governmentality spectrum. So again, non-state actors in international relations have been present. I mean, recently I was reading about sort of, you know, the sort of the political economy of colonialism and private company states were, you know, the foundations of empire. So
right.
So capitalism and non-state actors in the British and French empires, they had played a significant role in reproducing power relations and you know these sort of, you know, regimes. So that goes back way back in history.
This is why I raise this up as an issue, because what you're saying is they've always existed.
Yeah.
But they haven't done anything to really challenge states. In fact, if anything, they may be challenging other states, but they're doing so on behalf of particular state interests, right? So that in that sense, they're still doing the work of the state. So they're not undermining state power and this Westphalian kind of conceptualization of the or disorganized international system.
Exactly. It's like historically, company states, these sort of, you know, colonial, like extractivist sort of companies, they pushed the way how economic systems emerged, globalization, how it took shape. And same I could say now for Apple, Google, and other big techs. They're shaping how the sort of international system is operating. So there's some sort of continuity historically in this sense between sort of, you know, constitution of state and non-state actors and how they shape the system. So I would agree with the author, the own that you mentioned, that certainly technology has disrupted our traditional or existing ways of being and acting, but we should not underestimate the innovative or reinventive function of a state to catch up and retain power and authority.
Right. I mean, that's where I'm getting, where I suspect, based on my reading at least of Owen's argument, that when he makes the argument that, look, there are a new set of actors here, and this is a traditional kind of, I mean, even constructivist kind of argument about new actors, and what that the implications of that is not just that there's more actors, because you pointed out there have always been more actors, but that these actors are doing something different. They're not actually reifying state power. They're not actually, you know, cementing existing power imbalances. They're actually doing something different. They're disrupting the way things are taking place. And we can take maybe one of the kind of more violent extremes. We can talk about terrorist organizations, right? And their use of technology to challenge states. But again, you can think of individuals, you can think of, you know, in the constructivist sense of entrepreneurs, right? So entrepreneurial actors that are using these technologies to change and challenge state power rather than just to say, hey, we count to, but we will do what you want us to do. I think that Owen is talking more in terms of these, kind of like as an entrepreneurial actors are challenging states rather than as new actors that just want to be counted, but they're still doing the same thing and states are instrumentalizing them. Whereas I hear you as saying, which is perhaps a bit closer to my sense for different reasons, but I hear you saying that states still are able to capture these actors and do what they will.
Yeah, so I agree in that sense that, you know, entrepreneurs, non-state actors, they're a couple of steps ahead, always innovating and disrupting and changing the sort of state-centric system. But what's interesting about the state itself is that, you know, it kind of has the core of power. It has territory. It has a sort of, you know, concept of sovereignty, which is managing to come back and reassemble itself. And obviously the digital is one of the purposes of trying to disrupt that. I think Bahamas is the first country to open a digital, a virtual embassy, and sort of. So certainly, you know, we're seeing a lot of innovation going on, but we're also seeing the state catching up, and then, you know, like just think about social media, Twitter, Facebook. You know, people, not state actors, civil society have used it much more innovatively than the state. But then suddenly you see a surge in the kind of, you know, politicians using social media and making that the main platforms of democratic communication or public relations. Same as Twitter. So then you see that they dominate it. And now, you know, now we try to disrupt that and move on and create something else. So I think the dialectics here is that we're, our entrepreneurs are a couple of steps ahead. Certainly they're shaping and changing the landscape of how we do politics. But we should not underestimate the geopolitics, territoriality, state authority that tends to come back and catch up and then again, you know, capture.
Overwhelmed with resources, perhaps, since because it has so many resources.
Exactly. It has to do with the authority. It has to do with the legitimacy. It has to do with relationality. You know, people still are bound to the rights and obligations that are within a particular state. And as such, the digital obviously gives you the chance to escape that relationality, that you know, social construct you have with the state. But at the end of the day, you're a physical being.
Right.
You're not a virtual being. You have to take off your goggles and then, you know, get back to reality at some point. You can't always stay in your video game or, you know, in your virtual reality interaction. And that's where the state comes back. Because it's kind of real in a sense. It's more tangible.
Well, because I know Chris is dying to get in here, but I just one last comment, because we actually just finished an interview with Ilan Manor talking exactly on these kinds of issues, and I remember him, and I don't remember now, it should be in the program notes. We spoke a lot about different things, both on record and off record, but one of the things that he was talking about was that some state officials try to open, in the metaverse, they've tried to open up their presence, right? And they were boycotted, or they were, you know, like a lot of people were really upset that these states were kind of like, they're like, this is supposed to be our space, right? We don't want boundaries, but states somehow find a way to like, well, this is our embassy, you know, come and have a party at the House of Sweden or you know, you can be an e-citizen of Estonia. It's like the point was, you know, the metaverse, not the Facebook version of metaverse, but generally the metaverse was meant to be a space, right, devoid of these state presence and of all the other aspects of that. Anyways, thank you for that exchange. Chris, I'm sorry.
No. This is really interesting. And I think I'm just like left thinking about Facebook and Apple as kind of the Dutch East India companies of today, right? Of the 21st century. But unlike the Dutch East India Company, which kind of dealt in goods, they're dealing in data. And data is something that states crave. And you describe the state reassertion of control over this, and as we go forward, I'm wondering: are we going to see kind of a hardening of boundaries in these digital spaces, as opposed to having kind of a global kind of sphere where we can interact as states begin to kind of create sovereign borders in digital spaces? And harness these companies, whether social media or tech companies, so whether Apple or Huawei, to create their own kind of almost digital ecosystems, and how that seems like it would make a lot of social problems worse in terms of
we already are seeing that you know, Russia having their own internet, I presume China has the same. So certainly there is that sort of, you know, inclination, that movement taking place already. And then if you, I've been studying recently as well, the sort of cyber peace, which is a different from actually digital peace. Digital peace tends to kind of capture the whole study and also understanding of how technologies are used for peace processes. Whereas cyber peace has to do with the fact of finding an institutional international regulatory system to regulate cyber crimes, cyber threats, and cyber war. And if you look at the cyber peace early work at the UN at the moment, it's taking place. There are a couple of working groups and a couple of sort of, you know, and again, these are experts sponsored by key states who have legislated all other norms, international system, from human rights to decolonization to development and so on and so forth. So they are already capturing the regulation and governance of the cyberspace. And they talk about the same principles of the UN Charter applying also in the digital and cyberspace, cybersphere. So when they talk about international law and cyber threats, there is a consensus among all experts and all state-sponsored experts in the UN that international law applies to the cyber as it does apply to the analog or the other forms of warfare. So that's an example of upfront that, you know, international system is actually catching up. And we're going to have probably a covenant, a treaty, or an international system regulating drone use, or there'll be an assembly, or will be, so, you know, there'll be state parties. Already it's along the way to legislate this matter along similar other rules and norms in the international system. And that kind of goes back to what you were saying, that sort of state is managing to have a grip on what data they gather, who has access to them, and so on and so forth. At the moment, they're doing it kind of more informally, like, you know, the Israeli spyware, Pegasus and other sort of, you know, it's an example of how data is becoming lethal. Or how digital is becoming lethal to journalists, civil society activists, freedom fighters, and so on and so forth. In Myanmar, we've had ethnic cleansing, genocide taking place as a result of Facebook, allowing these postings and these images and this misinformation circulating. And, you know, this goes back to kind of, you know, clamping on occupied movement US, as well as across, Arab Spring, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's showing that the digital authoritarianism is more, the governmentality is kind of becoming more powerful than we thought, or quicker than we thought,
and a lot easier, it seems, than in the analog, right? So whereas 50 years ago, a state would have to hire legions of secret police to know what was happening in the homes of its citizens, today all it needs is just kind of one server where everything is uploaded, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm very much fond of the work of James C. Scott. I don't know if you know
right,
him.
Yeah.
You know, agrarian studies.
Yeah.
And I mean, in peace and conflict studies, at some point, we were kind of, you know, trying to really understand how do you understand the weapons of the weak or hidden transcripts and how this sort of, you know, Asian communities managed to really escape colonial, but also state systems. And they did it through offline politics, through this sort of unspoken, hidden, sort of very much intimate, encoded mimicries. In the digital, it will be really difficult to reenact those forms of agency, hidden transcripts of resistance. Obviously, probably we will develop a new transcript, of sort of, you know, resisting digitally, but it is more prone to be extracted, surveilled, and then curtailed.
Yeah, I'm reminded here of what the Chinese were doing in the Weibo, where they were using reference to, you know, Pooh the bear, in reference to the country's leader. And of course, the Chinese, you know, censorship eventually took it down. But you're talking about different ways, right? You have public and private, on stage, backstage kind of behaviors you're talking about. And eventually we do develop these euphemisms, this way of expressing something without actually saying it. And it is interesting because even the private is accessible more readily, as also Chris pointed out, in the age of kind of social media and digital technology. Now, we have talked a lot about digital peace and analog peace. Without really, and you defined it, you actually gave an excellent definition of that, but I really wanted to kind of go back to that because I promised our listeners about half hour ago that we would actually do that. So I want to do that really quickly and then move on to something more practical. How would you define digital peace?
Yeah, so I suppose the digital peace is the kind of the other of the analog peace. So for a long time, we've perceived peace in analog sense, a peace very much enshrined within a peace agreement that has to do with a particular people, territory, place, relations. So the analog peace was like very much the foundation of the modern state system. You know, interstate peace embedded on certain rules and norms and relations that they have to follow, sort of, you know, in order to continue peace. The digital peace tends to be a bit different. Digital peace tends to be very much and still we're evolving our understanding of digital peace. It is about these transnational networks, use of technology, but also sort of new ways of imagining how communities can coexist. And at the moment, the digital peace is not much different from the other notion with prefixes, as Chris was saying. So it's about peace taking place in the digital sphere. At least, you know, what civil society activists, think tanks, and UN is doing is trying to add a technological layer to peace processes, from utilizing data for conflict prevention, prediction, and analysis, to facilitating dialogue, peacemaking online, and to using machine learning to write constitutions or predict trends of post-conflict transitions. So there's a lot happening there. And digital peace tends to kind of encompass this sort of, you know, big spectrum of various technological tools brought into peace processes, either to understand, to facilitate, or implement peace.
Right. But in this sense, because you were talking about analog deals with more traditional kind of things that are just very much grounded in our lived realities, and digital peace is of a different nature. But it sounds to me, from what you're saying, and I could have misunderstood it completely, so I apologize, but from what you're saying, what sounded to me digital peace was, is just trying to achieve those same objectives, right? So it could be lowering tensions or restoring peace or predicting where the next conflict will take place, but this time using digital tools. Is it just a change in kind of like the instruments you're using? Is that, I mean, maybe it'll be more efficiency. And by the way, AI comes in here as well, right? We know that AI can be quite good, especially when it comes to predictive tools. So we're back into our territory here, Xim.
Yeah. No, you're right. So early evidence from the field shows that certainly sort of state and non-state actors have tried to use the digital as a way to overcome blockages of peace in the analog world. Sort of trying to kind of, you know, really cut down the complexities that you know, it involved with conflict analysis in the analog sense by using all sort of, you know, machine learning, social media, data collection, big data methods to facilitating peace processes online, earlier via Skype and then later on Zoom, and now kind of, you know, more kind of, you know, interactive methods. And recently we had Security Council ambassadors having their goggles on and being on the field. So it's really interesting.
But the end goal, Xim, is still achieving some kind of peaceful resolution for a conflict that is happening physically.
Well, that's the hope. But the problem is we're a bit disappointed with the way how the process of trying to apply digital technologies to peace processes is becoming the purpose itself rather than a means to address the root causes of conflict, resolve a conflict. So we're a bit distracted by the use of these tools, and we're forgetting what are the foundational problems, which myself and Oliver Richmond and others have been arguing that can only be resolved in the analog sense. So this is where we're kind of, you know, we're intervening in these debates, is that you know, for example, Syria is one of the most documented conflict in the world. What are we doing with that data, that knowledge? You know, are we bringing justice, you know, to the victims and people? Are we closing the conflict? Are we resolving it? We know so much about what's happening there. But where is this data going? It's going nowhere. So without political will, without political sort of, you know, compromise and methods of intervention that were in the analog, we're not able to really utilize this. And what's happening with the digital is that we're distracted by these innovations and seeing, like, you know, how interesting, how cool it is to predict, know, and you know, engage with these communities digitally. But then we're forgetting the end point.
So what would it look like? What would it look like if we're doing things differently? What would that different reality look like?
I think sort of it has to be a two-track approach, at least at this present age. You know, the traditional political, you know, negotiations and peacemaking should continue, while the digital data platforms should just support, facilitate, and sort of, you know, enable that process of conflict resolution. And at the moment, we're only seeing kind of, you know, flipping from one approach to the other, and rather than sort of, you know, having both involved. And remember, some of these conflicts are intractable. They're really difficult to resolve. I mean, look at Yemen, look at Syria. There's so many state actors involved, and the digital won't resolve its problems itself. You know what I mean? Regardless of how much content you have, or innovative ways of knowing and being you have, it won't, you know, achieve much.
I mean, the way it's you've described it, it seems like some of these technologies are almost more voyeuristic than peace-building tools, in a sense that you can have diplomats looking at VR goggles and get kind of experience what it's like to be in the Eastern DRC, but in the end, there's no different policy coming out. There's no political will coming out of
Chris. Would you have the Geneva and the Hague Accords, right, without the Belle Solferino and without Henry Dunant kind of experiencing that in person? And the answer probably is no, right? You go through that battle, it's atrocities, you look at it, you get shocked, and you say, you know what, we can't have this, we have to do something about it. So he goes and does something about it. And I suspect, right, that having that kind of ability to have that visceral experience, even in a virtual way, it could provide a similar kind of instigation, right, to somebody. It could drive certain people to action more than once. So even the voyeuristic aspect of it, perhaps. I mean, I'm being the positive here. Well, it's kind of weird me being the optimist here on the technical part. See what you've done. You've turned me the other way. I am making the argument in favor of. But it seems to me that you know there's still some value that can be retained through these technologies. In addition, let me add one more thing, because we've had a few people here, and Branka Panich, I think, talked about this, and she was being the optimist. So we urge our listeners to listen to both of these and kind of compare and contrast. But you know, talking about how technology can also provide real-time solutions in terms of education, right? Access to education, development, you know, other kinds of information that you would not otherwise have. One example, even in case of digital diplomacy, think about Zelensky and the fact that, you know, in any other conflict, as head of state, you probably would not be able to hear from him, right? Because he would be shut off. The Russians would probably have found a way to just completely shut him off. But he is ever present, right, in every nation's capital. And technology enables him to do this digital diplomacy, something that obviously would not have been possible in the past.
Let me give you a counterexample. July 2015, Erdogan taking FaceTime of a journalist live asking for counter-revolution. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. And I actually posed the same question to Ilan, and he qualified that. He said that is not actually an example of digital diplomacy, because it was done through a phone, which is a camera, really, into a traditional news station. So it was not a use of digital diplomacy, but it was actually just a use of a camera connecting to a TV station, unlike what Zelensky, in a way, is doing right now. So that's his explanation for it.
Yeah, but also the Zelensky is using phone and camera to transmit something.
Sure, but he's bypassing all these traditional ones. So the first thing that you would do, again, for our listeners, please go to episode 3 of this season interview, because he tells about this. So I'm just going to very quickly for all of us here. The first thing that you would do normally is you'd go and just shut down the TV channels, right? You'd either blow them up or you'd occupy them. That's the first thing you do. That's when you know a coup is underway. You know, with Zelensky, that would be useless. That would be pointless, because he can actually bypass all that, all those restrictions.
Yeah, but remember, De Gaulle used also BBC at some point to kind of, you know, transmit message.
So bypass restrictions.
Yeah, so you'll be surprised that in history you can find similar analogies. We're just, you know, repeating history in a way. But I totally agree that the digital, especially in peace building, where I'm interested, there's a lot of innovation. There's a lot of space for groups in conflict to meet virtually and feel safer sometimes. And sort of, you know, so there's a lot of positives here, especially when there are segregated ethnic communities. But then there's also the downside. And evidence shows across a lot of conflicts that people actually feel more censored to talk virtually or in these sort of digital spaces because of the fear that they are recorded and that will be used against them. And then there's also the problem of accessibility. Not all post-conflict settings have good internet technological tools. And those who participate in the digital debates or dialogues are those who have the means. So again, it reproduces this elite-driven ways of shaping peace processes and marginalizing again other communities, which again then it increases the resentment, resistance, hence the failure and buy-in from a wider society. So we are implanting the grounds for peace breaking in long term by just sort of, you know, reproducing the same ways of digital inclusion that we're thinking we're kind of, you know, changing the logic. Same is also with data collection from distance or remotely. We are missing a lot of sort of anthropological, ethnographical detail that you get about being on the ground. And machine learning, AI cannot capture that, what can't be said in public or in open space or in written.
It pushes us back to looking at kind of patterns in large amounts of data. And one thing is, I just like that you had pointed out there was kind of the use of radio in the 1930s and 1940s was something that allowed leaders to speak to other nations' publics as well, and was incredibly powerful at the time in a way that's perhaps analogous to some of what we are seeing today.
Well, even also in the misuse of technology, you had the same problem in Rwanda with the use of radio, as much like Facebook in a way in Myanmar, you could argue that radio was used to signal location of the Tutsis so the Hutus can find them out. So there's that aspect as well. So there are similarities, certain parallels. Sorry.
Right. And Medley, I know we were talking earlier before the show about an article by Guo, Gledish, and Wilson that had proposed an international consortium to be set up. In other words, to develop formal methods and models to steps society can take to wage war. And also, according to them, the consortium should involve academic institutions, international and government bodies, and industrial and charity interests in reconstruction and aid work. And the argument was that conflict prediction and prevention need a global data-driven system like those for forecasting the weather or epidemics, which in 2022 actually reads differently than perhaps the authors had intended at the time, and also maintenance in engineering. Hazim, how do you evaluate these proposals?
Yeah, so we wrote kind of a piece in Nature in response to that. Certainly, see, we're not short of predictive knowledge, but the way how international system works, the way how UN our decision makers work, is not through anticipatory and kind of, you know, preventive action, but only through reaction. And what the guys in that piece to try to kind of point out is that, you know, we have to really have that amount of knowledge, data, so that we build a case for sort of, you know, acting earlier. So I could see that the intentions were in the right place, but the risk there is that it will preemptively encourage interventions and hence do more harm than do good. And again, it misses the point that data itself, this knowledge itself, will not resolve these problems. You need political will, political agency, and capital. And that is through, you know, complex negotiation processes offline. And certainly that knowledge has to be complemented with sort of, you know, other sort of traditional means. So, the other concern we have is, especially with that piece, is the kind of the way how it kind of really was encouraging a neoliberal turn to kind of really, which would work in interest of big corporations, companies to extract and kind of, you know, utilize this field. And that would have significant implications for who are the stakeholders shaping peace processes. Excluding states and state itself, state actors, it's not a good idea in this process because, you know, they're the one who kind of are legitimate authorities in many places. So, you know, we had issues with that. And our view is that it needs to be, you know, a blended or kind of a more hybrid approach because look at Syria. We know so much about the conflict. Or Afghanistan, or other places, and at the end, you know, it doesn't serve much. So AI, it has other implications when it comes to really reading minds and complex sort of peace processes. I mean, they're talking about using AI to generate constitutions. You know, it sounds like maybe viable machine, you know, or technological wise, but imagine a social contract defined by a machine.
Right, and questions of legitimacy. Right.
Exactly. Like, you know, historically, these processes have taken place through a long-term struggles, debate, discussion. Look at the American sort of, you know, foundation. And then in the 90s, we've had UN and other technocrats imposing constitutions over post-conflict settings from Afghanistan to Iraq to Balkans and Bosnia, for example. Look at the Dayton Peace Accords. It was a world-ending arrangement, but now it's really not producing peace. It's just things have stagnated. And that involved some human agency, some negotiation, some balancing, some juggling with a lot of interests. Imagine if you try to eliminate all of that human agency and let the machine write the constitution.
I think that actually beyond the agency, as you point out, with agency goes, or rather beyond, but rather along with agency, there's a question of intentionality. Something we actually talked about in one of our conversations with Young Diogenes. We were discussing this idea of whether AI art is art. And there's a question, one of the authors that basically argued, no, it's not art because you have to have intention behind it. You can't just, and that gets to the issue because one of the big debates with the Supreme Court of the United States, especially in common law kind of systems, is what was the intended kind of thing? We do this even with regards to international treaties, right? You go back to the original drafters of the treaty of a particular statute and you look at the writings and say, okay, what were they struggling with? What were they trying to make compromises, and what was it you're trying to work out? So I follow you on that, and that's certainly. And I was also thinking of something. One more thing here before, and I'll have one last question because we're towards the end of our program here. But I guess before that, just one observation: the United States, in a way, we have a what if here. We have a counterfactual in this for this particular scenario in terms of predictability, right? So the United States was able to predict based on intelligence. Right, findings that it had, when and where Russia would, you know, what kind of actions Russia was going to take. Now, the counterfactual here goes both in favor of this consortium suggestion, or at least the predictive model, as well as against it. Against it, in the sense that, okay, it did not prevent the war. The war still, right, Putin still went through with it. But I'd argue there is some evidence for saying that this kind of predictive, all right, diplomacy, in a way, is useful because unlike any other time, the United States did something very unique where it kind of like laid all the cards on the table and says, this is what's going to happen. These are the kinds of things they're going to do, right? They'll do a false flag act here. They'll do this and that. And in fact, it seems to have actually affected the way the Russians, right, started the war and perhaps the kind of engagement that they did in a way to prove the Americans wrong, right? So there seems to be some value to this, right? Where if there is some predictive aspect to this saying, well, this is how it's going to go down, it may actually have an impact on the countries that are thinking about taking that action or actors are thinking. Because if you know what the others, if you know the other people know, then you're going to try and do something else. And that already affects your decision making. Any comments on that?
No, you're right in that sense. Prediction, it's about power, and it's kind of, you know, it can do good, but can also do harm. Sort of by anticipating things, you kind of, you know, preemptively take actions before the events take place. So that's certainly, again, going back to the governmentality question. People in power want prediction because predictions give them, you know, a headspace to act. But that can cause harm because, it can completely sort of distort future events. Or kind of, you know, plant future events in a way that might not occur in real time. And certainly there's here a fundamental problem because majority of people around the world don't really believe in predictive knowledge. Look at climate change or many other sort of, you know, warnings about health, you know, smoking or, you know. So we are very much relational, analog, grounded human, you know, creatures. So I suppose if you want to make predictive knowledge work, you need to kind of change the digital literacy or ways of thinking and acting. So people start taking that seriously, that sort of form of knowing. And it's really counterhuman at best. If you think that way, sort of, you know, we're not designed to, obviously we are cautious creatures, you know, and we learn from past events, internalize that, and then try to anticipate and act. That's why we survive. As human beings, but if we just enshrine that predictive knowledge and then modify current behavior around that, it's a big leap. And I presume it could work only through threat, fear, exposure, but also maybe some sort of, you know, click in our brain. we might need to together the right pill, you know, some sort of, you know.
Well, here's the last question. This is an easy one, but I suspect that it may actually prove to be challenging for you, considering how busy you are. But with summer fast approaching, we've decided that we would offer our listeners at least some recommendations in terms of reading. What do you have in your hands, and what would you recommend your listeners to read?
So I'm actually quite puzzled because, yeah, it's difficult to kind of pin down a single book. At the moment, I am working on a couple of projects, and one of them is on counterpiece. We're trying to understand international, local, and regional forces that are against peace, be that digital or analog. So when you're kind of working on a book project, you're actually more busy writing the book than sitting down and enjoying a single book. But what I'm planning to read over summer is actually Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate. Okay. And that kind of, you know, was really recommended at the beginning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I think it's an interesting book because it speaks about this sort of, you know, entrapment that we have in authoritarian state system, whereby we have to live a way, live a life in a way that we're not happy, or a double life, to sort of, you know, have a public self and a private one. And I think Life and Fate is one of those examples that is really timely. So I look forward to reading that. It's a really massive book, but it is set in the in Soviet Union in the 90s, during the sort of, you know, Soviet Union. And it really captures that sort of, you know, complex navigation during authoritarian, you know, era where human freedom agency is really suppressed by some sort of other great forces. And there's no better time to kind of, you know, go back to thinking about reinventing our human agency at a time where we are constantly curtailed by digital, you know, suppression or colonialism. And technological sort of, you know, dependency. And I bought the book physically because I'm very much, you know, yeah. I'm fed up of reading on the screen.
No e-books. Yeah, that's great to hear. I too still order physical yeah. books. I feel I spend too much time in front of a screen.
By the way, makes it very difficult. Chris and I are both in the process of moving, and it makes it very difficult and expensive to.
Well, more so for you.
yeah, certainly when you're crossing oceans, but it makes it very difficult to and very expensive to move around. But yeah, Chris.
Yeah, well, this was really great, and there's actually there's so much more to talk about, both in terms of kind of digital ways of knowing, and also the book that you recommended. But unfortunately, for today, we've already taken up so much of your time, and unfortunately, we have to close this episode. But as always, if you like the show, we invite you to subscribe and leave us a comment. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also follow us on Twitter at onair_podcast. And don't forget to join us for the next episode of On Air, a podcast at the intersection of AI and IR theory, law, and practice. Until then, stay human.